See, last time we noted, in connection with the chronology of the Exodus, that although a very good case can be made based on the biblical material, especially 1 Kings 6:1, to place the Exodus and the conquest in the context of a 15th century date, and that this seems to conform very well to the events of the 18th dynasty, specifically the reign of Queen Hatshepsut as the adoptive mother of Moses, the conflict between Moses and the future Thutmosis III, and then after his death, the return of Moses from Sinai and the exodus in the reign of Thutmosis' successor, Amenhotep II, that modern critical scholars have tended to move away from that and to place the date in the 13th century B.C., in the time of Ramesses II, approximately, in what is called the 19th dynasty of Egypt. Now, this did not happen until a lot of archaeological activity had taken place in what was ancient Canaan, on both sides of the Jordan River. And it was in the light of that archaeological research that scholars began to reject the 15th century date, and it was at that time that they began to make quite a fuss about, well, that number 480 is too round to be real. In other words, the modern critical scholars didn't immediately suspect the number. It was in the light of what they saw to be the archaeological, quote, evidence, and unquote, that they then went back to the text and said, now let me see, I think that number is suspect. Let's see if it could be understood in another way. And we will be coming later to what it was about the archaeological evidence that caused them to think in this fashion. We'll be doing that starting with the next lecture. So we talked about that being a stumbling block to them. And then, of course, they began to make a great deal of the mention of the city of Ramesses in Exodus 1, verse 11, and say, well, this obviously must refer to Ramesses II. If it was so obvious, why wasn't the question raised so much earlier? Well, because it isn't quite so obvious, it must have been. And therefore, it was only in the light again of the archaeological evidence that seemed to be pointing towards the 13th century date that they began then to pick up on Exodus 1:11 with the mention of the city of Ramesses and insist that it had to be Per-Ramesses, the estate city of Ramesses that he had built there in the Delta. And since there were no remains from the 15th century in the area where Ramesses built his cities, you know, underneath the foundations of Ramesses' cities, they said, hey, therefore this thing couldn't have happened any earlier. It couldn't have happened any earlier than the 13th century. Because they said, well, we had always assumed that the name Ramesses in the text was an historical updating of the text by some editor later on, in the same way that in Genesis 14, it mentions that Abraham pursued the kings who had taken Lot and his family captive. He had pursued them as far as Dan. Now, obviously, there was no such place called Dan in the days of Abraham. Dan is a son of Jacob, and it was during the period of the judges that they went up there and conquered the city and named it Dan. So there was no such place in the days of Abraham. And it's obviously an editorial updating, so people would know where it was. And so they had sort of assumed that this city that the Israelites were building in Egypt had been updated by a later editor to read Ramesses, because it was the same place where Ramesses later built his city. But then they began to get more curious in the light of the archaeological evidence in Canaan. And so they began examining it more carefully, and they came to the decision, well, there are no earlier foundations of this city that was built by Ramesses. So this couldn't be right. So that doesn't fit either. And then they began to consider the role of Hatshepsut more closely. And they said, well, there are a couple of problems with viewing Hatshepsut as the adoptive mother of Moses. There are no Egyptian records that speak about her adopting anyone as a son. The records say she was childless, but there are no records indicating she adopted anybody. And after all, if there are no Egyptian records, then she could not possibly have adopted somebody. Right? No. But that's what they would like us to believe. And then they raised what was really a more substantive issue, and that is that during the 15th century, and again, we're going to have to associate certain terms as meaning the same thing. 15th century B.C. equals 18th dynasty of Egypt equals the late Bronze I period archaeologically. 13th century, the date that the modern critical scholars proposed for the Exodus and the Conquest, equals 19th dynasty of Egypt, equals late Bronze to B, and the archaeological nomenclature. And I'm going to be using these terms interchangeably, and I won't always repeat all of them, so you have to know that they are synonymous. So once again, 15th century B.C. is the same as the 18th dynasty in Egypt, the late Bronze I archaeological period. The 13th century B.C. is the 19th dynasty of Egypt, or in the late Bronze II B period, archaeologically speaking, according to conventional dating. Now, a more substantive objection was raised to the Exodus having taken place in the 15th century, because after all, where were the Israelites living when they were enslaved in Egypt? What region of Egypt? Goshen, which is in the Delta region of Egypt, specifically the eastern Delta region of Egypt. The problem that was raised is that the 18th dynasty had its capital in Thebes, in Upper Egypt, which was 400 miles away from Goshen. 400 miles away. If the Exodus events took place in the 18th dynasty, that means Moses, if he was to have any contact with the Israelites and contact with Pharaoh, was a very early commuter, commuting between the Israelites in Goshen and the capital in Pharaoh, a distance of 400 miles one way. And yet he's shown talking to the Israelites, relaying God's messages to them, then going to Pharaoh, then bringing a message back from Pharaoh to the Israelites. This is an impossibility. And this is a much more substantive objection to putting it in the 18th dynasty. Then, a great deal had been made of the fact, when they were first discovered, of what are called the Tel El Amarna letters. The Tel El Amarna letters. Very important series of documents. Tel El Amarna was the site of the capital of Egypt during the reign of only one pharaoh. This was the pharaoh Akhenaten. Akhenaten is unique in Egyptian history. He is referred to as the heretic king because he attempted to impose upon Egypt the worship of only one god. He ordered all the temples of all the traditional gods closed, threw all their priests out of work, and tried to create a worship to a new god, identified with the sun, but a single supreme being. And he established a new capital in this place we now call Tel El Amarna. And in this new capital, he established a royal archive for not only his diplomatic correspondence, but he moved to the new capital the diplomatic correspondence that had taken place in at least the last half of his father's reign. And so we have the diplomatic correspondence for both Akhenaten and his father, Amenophis III. Now, that means this material covers the period from 1400 to about 1350 B.C. Now, why is this important if the correspondence begins at around the year 1400? Why does that have any bearing on our matter of the Exodus and the Conquest? Well, if that we go by the traditional date, the Exodus is in 1443. And the Conquest, then, is in 1403. And so this archive begins to involve diplomatic correspondence from the period when Israel, by traditional dating, would have been beginning its conquest of Canaan. And this archive contains letters from Canaanite kings to the Egyptian court, reporting on conditions in Canaan at the time. And so if the traditional date is correct, we would expect to find some mention in this record, these letters, of the Israelites invading Canaan. And what caused a great deal of excitement is that when they uncovered these letters from the king of Jerusalem, letters from the king of Hazor, letters from the king of Megiddo, they all mention a group of people called Apiru, who are disrupting the state of affairs in Canaan. They are fighting against the loyal subjects of the Pharaoh. They are destroying and plundering cities. They are tearing away people from the loyalty to the Egyptians. They are completely destabilizing the region. Now, as I said, this caused a lot of excitement when these documents were first uncovered, because originally they read this name Apiru as Habiru. Habiru. Very close to Hebrew. And of course it dates from the time when by traditional dating we would expect the Israelites to be unleashing a lot of trouble in Canaan, you know, destabilizing the region. And so people, as I say, got very excited because this seemed to confirm the traditional date for the Exodus and the conquest. Well, as modern critical scholars have pointed out quite correctly, the correct reading of the term is not Habiru, but Apiru. Apiru, which is not necessarily linguistically linked with Hebrew anyway, the word Hebrew. Second, the term Apiru is not an ethnic term. It is a descriptor of any group which stands outside the established social order. Any group that stands outside the established social order is called Apiru in the Near East, everywhere from about 2000 BC down to about 600 BC. In other words, the usage of the term Apiru begins as early as 2000 BC in various records. And you find mention of Apiru in various places all the way from the Persian Gulf to Egypt, all the way down to 600 BC. The term is too general to be accepted as a clear indication that this is the record of Israel invading Canaan. And they are quite correct in that. You cannot say the mention of Apiru in this record proves that the Israelites were in Canaan. So they're quite correct in raising that objection. Then another problem cropped up. We turn in the Bible to Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. And we read in verse 14, or beginning in verse 14, that Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers. When we cried out to the Eternal, he heard our voice, and sent the angel and brought us up out of Egypt. And now we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. And this is the key part, verse 17. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through the fields or the vineyards, nor will we drink water from the wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or the left until we have passed through your territory. And Edom said, you shall not pass through my land, lest I come out against you with the sword. And so the children of Israel said, well, we'll go by the highway, and if I or my livestock drink any of your water, then we'll pay for it. Only let us pass through on foot, nothing more. And he said, meaning, you shall not pass through. And so Edom came out against them with many men with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So Israel turned away. Now, we've already looked at this in the map we did. The modern critics said, hey, wait a minute. This implies you've got a strong, settled community there in Edom, strong enough to force the Israelites to turn and go around them. Now, the same thing would be said of Moab, because the Israelites likewise asked permission of Moab if they could pass through their territory, and the Moabites likewise refused. So So Israel, as we saw on the map we completed, went around Moab. And so we have textual evidence in the Bible that the Israelites ran into strong opposition from both Edom and Moab and had to go around those areas. Then in the 1930s, Nelson Glick, his name is not spelled as you might think, the Nelson part's okay. It's G-L-E-U-C-K, but it's pronounced Glick. Nelson Glick of the Hebrew Union College, the Reformed Jewish Seminary, conducted an archaeological survey of Transjordan, the area of Ammon, the kingdom of Zion, the Amorite, Moab, and Edom. And his conclusion after completing his survey was as follows. There were no settled communities in that area all the way between 2300 B.C. and 1300 B.C. The area was uninhabited. Nobody lived there all the time between 2300 B.C. and 1300 B.C. Now, what he meant to say by this is that nobody lived there from the end of the early Bronze Age until the beginning of the Iron Age. I'm going to come back to that because it's an interesting point that I want to pick up a little later. But he said, during this period of time, from the end of the early Bronze Age in 2300 B.C., till the beginning of the Iron Age in 1300 B.C., nobody lived there. So if Israel faced an Edom and a Moab that forced them to go around, it could not have taken place anywhere between those dates. There's nobody there. They could have gone right through. It would have been empty. So, again, how can you put the Exodus and the conquest in the 15th century? Because that would mean they were going through here in the 1400s. There would have been nobody there to turn them away. So the Exodus must have been later. It must have been in the 1200s. It must have been in the 13th century. Finally, the modern critics came up with another interesting point. And this is as follows. That in the year approximately 1300 B.C., Pharaoh Seti I campaigned in Canaan. He makes no mention of Israel. But if Israel had been in the country since 1400, the traditional date of the conquest, how is it possible 100 years later he makes no mention of them in his campaign records? Very strange. Around the year 1290, Ramses II campaigned in Canaan. And he doesn't mention Israel either. Ergo, Israel was not yet there. See? And then around 1225 approximately, or 1222, some want to say, Pharaoh Merneptah, all of these are 19th dynasty pharaohs, by the way, campaigned in Canaan. And aha! In his campaign records, he mentions Israel. In fact, it is the first documentary evidence of the name Israel that appears anywhere in the Near East that we have found. This Stela of Merneptah mentions that he campaigned in Canaan and he destroyed various cities and peoples, and he mentions parenthetically that Israel is laid waste, her seed is not. So it's the first mention of Israel. And he says, I ran into these Israelites, and I devastated them. They were devastated. So the first time the Egyptian records mention Israel as being in the land, even though pharaohs have campaigned there for a long time, is in 1225. Ergo, they must have arrived between what dates? Between 1290, when Ramses didn't find them, and 1225, when Merneptah did find them. Somewhere in there, they must have arrived. Now remember, if we rework those 480 years the way the modern critics would like, and we consider that what it preserves is a memory of 12 generations, and we reduce the length of a generation from a very unrealistic 40 years, granted it's unrealistic, to a more realistic 25 years, 25 years per generation, we come out with 300 years. So if we go back from 965 B.C., remember the fourth year of Solomon, approximately 965 B.C., that's the year that's mentioned in 1 Kings 6:1. We go back 300 years, we end up with a date for the Exodus of about 1265 B.C., based on the refined or reformed reading of 1 Kings 6:1, we arrive at a date of 1265, which puts it in the reign of Ramses II, late in his reign. And that gives about 40 years for them to make it to Israel, to Canaan, and be there when Meneptah finds them. That works out very nicely, see? Can you see? They left around 1265 and spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness. They're there just about the time Meneptah finds them. So everything seems to fit very, very nicely. The reason why I'm doing this is to show you that these modern critics weren't just a bunch of anti-Bible people that hated the Bible and wanted to just make hash of it somehow. There were a lot of things that seemed to point, you know, very clearly in this direction, that this is the way it should be understood. And indeed, even going back to the campaigns of these pharaohs, Seti, Ra, and Ramses, not only did the Egyptians not mention Israel, but if Israel was already in the land, if they had come back in 1400 the way the traditional date put it, what period of Israel's history would they have been in this period of Seti and Ramses? What do we call that period of time? The period of the judges. And we have the book of the judges that records Israel's problems with conquerors, you know, that conquered them in the period of the judges, right? Does the book of the judges mention being conquered by Seti or even just Pharaoh anonymously? No. And there's no mention of any Egyptian conquest in the book of Judges in the time of Ramses either. So not only do the Egyptians not mention Israel, but the Bible doesn't mention the Egyptians. And so therefore that seems to confirm again that they weren't there yet. That's why the book of the Judges doesn't mention them. So these are the major arguments, of course, that have been used by the modern critical school. To sum them up again, very quickly, is that the city of Ramses mentioned in Exodus chapter 1 has to refer to Ramses II's capital, and underneath that capital there is no trace of any earlier cities. So therefore it could not have been an earlier city that the Israelites built that was renamed Ramses, and that's how the name entered the text. That won't work. Second, the 15th century dynasty of Egypt, the 18th dynasty, the one that ruled in the 15th century B.C., had its capital 400 miles away from the Delta region where the Israelites were enslaved. This makes it impossible for them to have been the dynasty that was involved in these incidents, because then Moses would have been commuting a round trip of 800 miles on a frequent basis, and that doesn't make any sense. Third, Hatshepsut could not have been the adoptive mother of Moses, because the Egyptian records do not recall her ever adopting anyone, Hebrew or Egyptian, as a son. Fourth, the survey of Nelson Glick in Transjordan showed that the area was empty of population between the end of the early Bronze Age in 2300 B.C. until the beginning of the Iron Age in 1300 B.C. And therefore, since Edom and Moab are listed in the scripture as refusing the Israelites the permission to pass, the Israelites must have come along after 1300 B.C. to be refused permission. Fourth, the Tell El Amarna tablets, with their mention of the Apiru destabilizing conditions in Canaan, while very attractive for an early date of the Exodus around in the 15th century, you cannot use it as proof because the term Apiru is too general a term. It applies to too many different groups of people over too wide a span of time to be proof of the Israelites in Canaan. And last, going back to the initial scripture we started with, 1 Kings 6:1, the 480 years from the fourth year of Solomon back to the Exodus, it's too round a number to be a literal year count. It must be the reflection that they knew they were 12 generations from Solomon's day back to the Exodus, based on 1 Chronicles chapter 6, where they have the 12 generations of the high priests. They knew that much, and they made a mistake. They multiplied the 12 generations by 40 years, coming out with an impossibly large number. They should have multiplied the 12 generations by 25 years, and then they would have come out with 300 years, and then 300 years before Solomon would have put it back in the 13th century, the time of Ramesses. And last, the Pharaoh Seti and Ramesses campaigned in Canaan. They make no mention of Israel. The Bible makes no mention of them, therefore Israel was not yet there. But since Merneptah does mention Israel in his Stela of 1225, Israel must have arrived somewhere between Ramesses' campaign, which fails to mention them in 1290, and Merneptah's campaign, which does recognize them in 1225. Okay, what have the traditionalist scholars done? Have they all decided to slink away into the darkness and nurse their sense of grievance and say, well, I still believe the Bible anyway? Is that all they have done? No. They have been very active. Now, let's take a look and see what they have done. And I think what will help you in this regard is to look at some of these handouts. So if we can have some people give these out. I will add some additional comments. You want to do that one? Okay. Mr. Manamika, would you hand this one out? Can somebody else hand this one out on this side?
Are there differences?
If you will look at the handout that has at the upper, well, the title is Analysis of Attempts by Modern Critical Scholars to Discredit a 15th Century Date for the Exodus and the Israelite Conquest. We'll look at this one first. We've already noted that 1 Kings 6:1 indicates that the fourth year of Solomon was 480 years after the Exodus. That's what the text says. Since Solomon's fourth year was 965 B.C. approximately, the Exodus would be placed approximately in 1445 B.C. We've noted the modern critical criticism that the number 480 is too round to be authentic, that the actual biblical writer did not know literally how many years separated the Exodus from Solomon, but did know it was 12 generations, since there are 12 generations of priests mentioned from the time of the Exodus, Eliezer, to Solomon, Azariah. Now, you notice I have a section here expanding on that, because some people have noted a problem in the text. Why don't you take a look at 1 Chronicles 6, because I'm sorry, you need to correct your handout. It says 1 Chronicles 4-9. It should be 1 Chronicles 6, verses 1 through 10. Okay, 1 Chronicles 6, verses 1 through 10, mention the 12 generations of the priests from Eleazar to Azariah, who served in Solomon's temple. Now, there is a problem with the transmission of the text, almost certainly. Tzadok, who is mentioned in verse 8, was still alive at the beginning of Solomon's reign. In fact, upon David's advice, Solomon got rid of the other man who was a major high priest, Abiathar, and used only Tzadok. Zadok actually anointed Solomon to become king over Israel. So he was certainly alive at the beginning of Solomon's reign. If the temple was begun in the fourth year of Solomon and finished, you know, a short time thereafter, it seems impossible that it was the great-great-grandson of Zadok who was the first to serve in the temple. That doesn't make any sense. You'll notice that parenthetical statement in verse 10. It says, Yochanan began that one must consider 25 years to be a real figure for a generation. I won't argue with them on it. I don't know of many people that will. 25 years is a much more acceptable length of time when you consider the time between the birth of one generation and the next. But notice what they have not done. They have insisted on zeroing in on this lineage of the priests, which is 12 generations long, from the time of Moses to the time of the temple. The problem is, it's not a complete genealogy. What we have here is an artificial genealogy. Notice my comment in the last column on the right. The genealogy from Eliezer to Azariah is probably artificial. Why? Because 1 Chronicles 6, verses 33 to 37, lists 19 generations for the same time span from the Exodus to Solomon. Running backwards from Henon, who was a singer in Solomon's lifetime, back to Korah. You have 19 generations that are mentioned for this line of singers, while only 12 generations for the line of priests. Now, therefore, it seems this line of priests is artificially shortened. Now, why should the writer have left some people out? Notice, the author of 1 Chronicles possibly skipped some generations in the high priest lineage in order to construct a symmetrical pattern of two sets of 12 generations. The first set running from Eliezer, the Exodus generation, through Azariah, the generation which saw the foundation of Solomon's temple. Then you have another set of 12 generations from Azariah, who saw the first temple built, to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, who saw the founding of the second temple. And so you get a symmetrical arrangement of 12 and 12. Now, why should we believe the writer did this? Because we have a good precedent for such. In Matthew's genealogy of Christ, you do have absolutely, without question, an artificial genealogy. Not a literal one. That doesn't mean extra people were invented. No. People were left out. Generations were skipped to create an artificial relationship of 14 generations from Abraham to David, and then 14 generations from the David's reign to captivity, and then 14 generations from the captivity to Christ. Now, how do we know it's artificial? Now, we can't test the whole genealogy. We don't have a literal biblical record of the genealogy from the time of the captivity to Christ, you know, elsewhere in the Bible to compare it with. That's beyond our ability to work with. We cannot clearly work with the generations from Abraham to David to know if we've lost somebody. But we have the whole biblical record of the line of David from the time of David to the carrying away of Judah. And if we look at Matthew's genealogy, from David to the captivity, four kings of Judah are omitted. They do not mention Ahaziah, Joash, Amaziah, and Jehoiakim. Four kings in David's lineage who ruled over Judah are omitted in Matthew's genealogy. They obviously were omitted in order to reduce this time, the number of generations from David to the captivity to be 14, so that it would form this symmetrical pattern. You can go back and check it yourself sometime. And you will see that it says so-and-so begat so-and-so. It doesn't mean literally begat, but in the sense that it begat somebody who eventually begat that person. That's the way it's meant to be taken. Now, we wouldn't write history that way. But they didn't see anything wrong with doing it that way. This is not an uncommon thing in the Near East. In the same way, in the book of Daniel, Belshazzar is referred to as being the son of Nebuchadnezzar, or reverse. Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as Belshazzar's father. Well, he wasn't Belshazzar's father. He was his grandfather on the mother's side. But that doesn't matter, because in those days, that's the way people wrote. They just ignored those small technicalities. We have to accept the written literature in the way they wrote then. That's the only way it makes sense. And it is quite obvious, as I say, from Matthew's genealogy, that four kings were omitted. And so therefore we have a precedent for people being dropped out because they want to create an artificial symmetry. Now, the interesting thing is, if the generations of the singers is correct, and you take 19 generations times 25 years per generation, how many years do you come out with? 475 years. And we're assuming, of course, that 25 is the right number for a generation. You know, we're making that assumption. We're not going to hassle with the modern critics too much. You still come out with the same time span, just about, as the text says. The text says 480. If you do the mathematics, not using the priest generation, but using the generations of the singers, you end up with the same time span. And so therefore, the Bible is still indicating it was approximately 480 years between the Exodus and Solomon. Notice something that they don't usually deal with in the modern critical literature, the comment in Judges 11:26. In that scripture, Jephthah refers to Israel's occupation of the land east of the Jordan as having lasted for 300 years. Now, Jephthah lived around 1100 B.C. Nobody disputes that. Now, Jephthah is saying, Israel conquered the land 300 years before me. He's talking not about the Exodus, he's talking about the conquest. Well, what's 300 years before 1100 B.C.? 1400 B.C. So here are two separate scriptures that, coincidentally, in quotes, point you back to the same time period. Or is it just a coincidence? Now we come on the reverse side of the sheet to the problem of Moses being the daughter of Hatshepsut. Notice in the last column on the right, an abundance of royal sons in the 19th dynasty make it very unlikely that a throne princess would have incurred the strong social disapproval involved in adopting a Hebrew child. One can understand Hatshepsut adopting a child, since she was childless. But all of the throne princesses in the 19th dynasty, that period of the 13th century, had loads of sons. Why should they have felt motivated to adopt a slave child as a son? Doesn't seem to fit. Hatshepsut not only lacked a son, but is known to have had a very strong and independent spirit, strong enough to make herself Pharaoh of Egypt. Having an adopted son who could be the heir to the throne would help explain her seizure of the throne to prevent Thutmose III from assuming real power. And the fact that Thutmose III was able to seize the throne from Hatshepsut approximately 1485, the very time period when Moses would have been 40 years of age when he fled from Egypt, is, as we've noted before, important. Now, why is there no mention of Hatshepsut's adoption? Since Thutmose III destroyed or defaced all the inscriptions and monuments of Hatshepsut, should we really expect to find any records of Moses as her adopted son? I think that is self-explanatory. The matter of the Amarna tablets, I admit, is a matter that is neither here nor there. If we, for other good reasons, can place the Israelites in Canaan in 1400 B.C., then the apiru that are mentioned, the letters, would probably refer to them. But by themselves, they are not, as the modern critics are quite correct in saying. They're not by themselves proof of their being there. Quickly, let's look at the matters dealing with Exodus 1:11, the city of Ramses in Egypt. The comment to the modern critical scholars would be apt if they were completely correct. You can look at this material later. It is true that there is no earlier remains under Ramses City. However, adjoining Ramses City, there are remains from the 18th dynasty, the 15th century, in the area immediately adjoining Ramses City. And therefore, it would not be surprising that the area the Israelites had lived in the 15th century is renamed because of the much later but much more famous nearby, I mean, not even nearby, but adjoining town built by Ramses. What about the capital of the 18th dynasty being so far away? Notice the last column here at the top. There is enough proof that the pharaohs of the 18th dynasty did spend time in the Delta and initiated construction projects there. Thutmose III not only appointed a vizier for his capital at Thebes, but also had one for the Delta, the ancient northern capital of Memphis. He was responsible for major construction at Memphis and Heliopolis. So he could have been the pharaoh putting the Israelites to hard labor there. Amenhotep II, the pharaoh we believe to be the pharaoh of the Exodus, was actually born in Memphis in the north and appears to have had extensive estates there. And so, therefore, there's nothing that prevents the pharaoh from having been located periodically close to Goshen, eliminating Moses' commuting problem. Numbers 20 and the mention of Edom and Moab forbidding Israel passage. A lot of problems with Glick's work. First of all, what kind of an investigation was it? A survey. A survey, by its nature, only looks at the surface pottery. Every excavator knows that when you look only at the surface pottery, you miss many periods when people were living there. You cannot definitively prove lack of population from a surface survey. Even Albright, who wrote extensively that he agreed with Glick, only did one excavation in Moab to test whether Glick was right. And maybe that one site wasn't inhabited during that time. But you can't prove there was no habitation at that time. Afterwards, people have done extensive excavations in Transjordan, and they have found there were cities there at the time. It was not empty of population. And I'm going to pick up with this topic again because it's a very extensive and important one next time when we begin the matter of the chronology of the conquest, because this is really where it also fits. So I'll pick up on the refutation of Glick's work then.